big data and machine learning for public health. Okay?
Well, it's lovely to see you all today. I hope that I will enthuse you with the value of machine learning when we have to deal with absolutely massive data sets. So, sorry, let me make sure this goes back to full screen. Okay, so we only have 15 minutes, so it's going to be a little whirlwind ride, so I want to show you a few different areas. So forgive me if it's a bit rushed, but I hope you'll hold on to your hats and we can take a look at some of these things. So I feel passionately that whatever we do should have some practical human benefit. And so what we've done is we've teamed up with the Veterans Administration, the country's largest healthcare provider. So they help to provide healthcare for about 7 million people. And the underlying goal is that there are some key societal issues, and we would like to have some timely alerts that would help prevent those, because prevention is better than cure. So one of the obvious things would be asthma, for example. There's 23 million people, at least in the country, that have asthma. So a timely alert could be the difference between a good day or a really bad day in the ER. Ultimate bad day could be the patient dying. So, but it's not just asthma. There's a whole range of other health conditions that are affected by our environment, and that was recently highlighted by a World Health Organization report that estimated in 2012 there were 7 million people that died globally related to air pollution. So my point is a very simple one. We know very well that there are environmental impacts on health, but we actually haven't quantified very well our environmental conditions. So my dream, and it's becoming a reality, is to have neighborhood scale environmental conditions that could be used in real-time alerting. Now, there are some logistics associated with getting there, just the sheer volume of data. So the study I'm going to show you in a minute used 40 terabytes of data. So if you had a regular internet connection, at the moment the average maybe for the country is around 10 megabits per second, it would, just to download it using 24/7 your connection all the time, it would take 185 days. So just to get the data moved around is a severe logistical issue. So we're also part of another project with something called US Ignite, which is something out of the White House and NSF, where we're looking at the next generation of application for very high bandwidth, low latency networks, which, for example, if instead of having a 10 megabit connection, we had a 1 gigabit connection, that would then only take one day, 21 hours. So only, that's still a long time. And every day there's an update to this data set of about 4 gigabytes, which would then just take 32 seconds to download. So something that goes from the intractable can become very tractable by the confluence of several things. And the heart of all of that is the machine learning. And I also feel passionately that we need to break down the barriers between different areas. So we already saw in our early talks that there's a really intersection between the environment, the medicine, the geography, and so on. And so we live in an exciting age where we have unprecedented amounts of information we're routinely collecting. On the one hand, for the bioinformatics, we're sequencing entire genomes. And then also with the electronic health records, we have massive amounts of this data. But of course, that's often in different medical health record systems. So even for a given type of data, there can be barriers. But then some of those environmental factors that are driving those health outcomes, which in turn how we respond to them is affected by our genetics, they can be in these different silos. So a very key thing I think we have to do is to break down the barriers between those different areas, and that's what I've embarked on doing using the machine learning, bringing together massive disparate data sets that help us address these very significant issues. So we'll take a really quick look at one of these, airborne particulates. So we've heard about mold earlier, and we heard about the coal dust and so on. So airborne particulates that are really small, 2.5 microns in diameter and less, have often been called an invisible killer. So if we thought of our world as a village of 100 people, 32 of us would be breathing very polluted air. And when I talk about these small particulates, if you're not familiar with them, they're really small. So on the top left, you see a human hair. Then the next one across, you see a grain of sand. And on the far right, you see one of these particulates I'm talking about. So you can have multiple particulates of this size laid across a human hair. They're really small. And because they're so small, they get past the filter hairs in our nose, down into our lungs, and they cause a massive set of impacts. So this small font chart, which is hard to read here, is just really intended to give the impact of how many different areas of human health these are known to affect, from general mortality to cardiovascular, pulmonary, a whole range of effects, even to reproductive health, low birth weight, infant mortality, sperm quality. So it's just things that you think, how on earth would that be to do with air pollution actually turn out to be? So, the challenge is, where are we going to get the data on these particulates? So, typically, we have instruments such as this making the measurements. Now, I don't know if any of you have seen these. You don't normally see them on every street corner. And that's kind of my point. So, these red dots you see scattered across the map, it's a bit sad to say it represents many years of my life. I've managed to get hourly observations from more than 8,000 stations in more than 55 countries over the last 2 decades. So what would be ideal is that we could have the information that these individual stations are collecting everywhere. So if you or I have a health condition, we heard in the last talk and in the talk before that, that there are different impacts. If we could have a timely alert, or, for example, if we just have a newborn child and we want to take them out for a walk, when you walk down the street, that child in the stroller is at exhaust pipe, you know, tailpipe level. So the amount of pollutants they're receiving is pretty drastic. So just going a meter back from the curb, or better still, a different route through town could make a massive difference. But how do you know which route to take? How do you know what you're breathing unless we're measuring it? So now we're also building wearable sensors so that we can come down to the much finer granularity. But in this study, what I did is I related the observations from these stations made hourly over 2 decades with a range of 50 different parameters that are ubiquitously available, from satellites, from the meteorology, from population density, and there was a very massive non-linear, non-parametric relationship between these variables that I was able to learn using the machine learning. So this is just an overview of some of the parameters. And so the bottom line of it, this is the average of more than 6,000 days from August 1997 to the present, and the rainbow color scale represents the density of these airborne particulates in micrograms per cubic meter. And essentially, where you see red on this plot, you have persistently high airborne particulates over a very long period. So we heard mention of China earlier. So in this area up here in northern China, it's estimated that the life expectancy has been reduced by at least 5 years because of the burning of coal. We heard a little about that. But then if you want a drastic example, around here, around the Aral Sea, the life expectancy is 27 years. And that's because in the middle of the Aral Sea, there was a Soviet biological weapons testing facility. But then Uzbekistan decided they wanted to irrigate their cotton fields using water from the Aral Sea. And unfortunately, because the canals were poorly constructed, they drained the Aral Sea, pretty much. And so what was an isolated island now became a windswept dust bowl, anthrax-type dust bowl, and so the life expectancy there is pretty short. So they are extreme examples, but they kind of make the point that these airborne particulates can have a really extreme in high concentrations effect on our health, but even in lower concentrations, they have noticeable impacts. So I want to have this type of data on a daily basis readily available to have these real-time alerts to help physicians put in context the cases they're seeing, and even have optimized logistics for staffing emergency rooms and so on. Say, looking historically, thank you, over the last decade for these 7 million people being served, you have a significant mapping between the environmental state and what conditions you are seeing, what supplies were needed, so you can optimize staffing levels and so on. So essentially this big picture flowchart is recursively using the machine learning on multiple levels. So at the lowest level we've talked about, I bring together these multiple massive data sets to estimate using the machine learning the airborne concentration of these different pollutants. And then we do the same thing again to relate the environmental condition to the ER admissions for all ICD codes and likewise for prescriptions. So then we can learn what are those elephants in the room, what are the significant triggers that seem to be present between health outcomes and the environmental conditions. So, but the same approach could be used in many other areas. For example, for this machine learning can be used to highlight where fires are going to break out, for smart agriculture, even for water resources. So that's beyond the scope of this session, but I just want to point out this is a very generically useful approach that is not just limited to the examples I've mentioned. And finally, for vector-borne diseases. So the same remote sensing that I mentioned we've been using, we can identify all the water bodies on the planet. And in addition, the mosquitoes to breed that then cause up to 219 million cases of malaria a year, for these mosquitoes to breed, they need a certain temperature range, humidity range, and so on. And so we have all that information as well. So we can have either proactive measures such as filling in a wheel rut 6 foot long, a few inches wide, where the mosquitoes are breeding, or preemptive spraying, or preparing suitable supplies of medications to help deal with it. So this is very much a proactive vision, with prevention being better than cure. And I could give you lots of more examples, but I think I will stop there. Thank you. So actually, it's a revolution that is now becoming pretty widely available, and for many of these things, you don't even have to pay for the tools. They're open source tools. So there, I'm not using these, all of these open source tools, but I'll tell you about them in case you wanted to try for free. So R is a statistical language that has a whole range of contributed libraries, and you will find a lot of machine learning functionality there. Also Python, there's a lot of tools, and that's growing all the time. It's a very big community. And then I personally use MATLAB because it is very well documented, but that does have a license fee. But then there's things also like SAS or IBM's tools, SPSS. There's a whole range of different things and other online things that are growing up all the time. So Yes, there are many things available, and it's a really exciting area. I mean, it solved some intractable problems for me that I could have done no other way. I'm not quite sure exactly what you're asking me. The size of these data sets I'm dealing with are massive, so the tools that I've been using have had to be able to handle them. However, the techniques are not specific to this. They're more generic statistical techniques. And I think the main difference that I've seen, and maybe others can expand on it, is that historically in epidemiology and those public health type environments, they are not using these multivariate, nonlinear, non-parametric. They, even if they're multivariate, they're assuming some functional form. So the main difference between that and the machine learning is we're not a priori assuming any functional form. And that's really important because often we're dealing with variables that not only are they not Gaussianly distributed, they are highly nonlinear. So when I talk about many parameters, like this study that I told about the aerosols, that was about 50 different variables. But others, like we did one for life expectancy, where we considered up to 13,000. And it turned out 7 of those were way more significant than the others. But the key approach is, instead of pre-selecting a priori and saying these are the important factors, when it's easy that we could have missed something, it actually gives you objective tools to say, okay, you can take all of the data, and it turns out that these are the most important in this order. So,
is that different?
Yes. So the difference between, for example, if you did a principal component analysis and some of these techniques I'm doing, is the principal component type of analysis will struggle when you have a highly nonlinear system. Whereas for these approaches, it doesn't actually matter if they are highly nonlinear. They'll deal with it much better, and also when it's non-Gaussianly distributed variables.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you.